This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo from Joy 94.9 across Australia on the Community Radio Network with Adam and Peter.
Margherita Coppolino is one of those people you can't miss. She's been through some extraordinary journeys in her life.
A lot of people in Melbourne will know her, although they will not recall her name.
She has many talents. One look at her webpage instantly tells you that she's equipped to confront issues in her life.
She has been referred to as disabled, but we don't think this is the right term for Margherita. She has different abilities to experience life through different criteria than most of us.
Margherita has identified as lesbian, and she recently tried to track down her birth mother.
Margherita joins us today to share some of her stories. Margherita, welcome to Allegro Non Troppo.
And it's an absolute honour to be here today. Thank you for inviting me.
It's an honour to have you here. Now, we're not telling the listener everything about you. We're going to take the listener on a journey of discovery. Margherita, they say you're disabled, right? Mm. And in articles they've said that you're disabled. Could you tell us the nature of this disability?
Okay. Well, the disabled term, if I was to use the correct terminology, they say dwarfism in the medical terms. But here in Australia, we actually use the term short stature. Mm-hmm. So for some people who don't identify with either of those two words, it means being a person who has bone deformities and will never be over 4'11" in height.
Now, you have a chondroplasia?
That's the most common type. There are over 170 different types of dwarfism types in the world. The type that I actually belong to is quite rare because all of this is just the limbs.
Yeah.
I have very large feet, which I keep tripping over, so something big had to be about me. It had to be in my feet. And with my type, because it's quite rare, we find that the terminology actually came from the eugenic tribes, so that's okay. All they know at this stage.
Just as a point of interest, Adam mentioned the term chondroplasia. Would you like to explain what that is?
A chondroplasia is when the body develops, but the limbs don't develop.
Right.
The limbs don't grow, so it's like it's a genetic thing, isn't it, Margherita?
It is, and with my term, one of the things that I know about my background, there was no form of dwarfism in my family background, so that's why, you know, the type's actually quite rare. It just happened. So,
how tall are you?
Well, I'd like to say I'm 4 foot, but I'm about a foot of an inch off 4 foot.
Okay.
But the other way of looking at it, with all the hats that I wear, I'm probably about 8 feet.
I would say
anyway,
so.
Anyway, what's a quarter of an inch between friends anyway?
Exactly.
Margherita, so your body and head are normal sized,
yep.
Right, but your limbs are short.
That's
and,
correct.
And your feet are normal sized. What about other parts? Does everything else work all right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, considering the limbs are quite short, they actually function quite well. One of the things that I noticed with having a very long back, particularly when masseurs are working on my back, they realise how strong it is.
Mm-hmm.
So had I been born average height, and I'll use the
apostrophes, yeah.
Thank you. I would have been quite tall. So if you notice when I sit out, I'm quite tall.
Yes.
So either way, I would have missed out somewhere along the line.
Mm. Is there any other conditions come from this from your dwarfism that affect you physically?
No, not really. I think the only thing that it really has impact is it's probably just how society sees it.
Mm.
As I've got older, I don't say as I've grown up, because every time I say I grow up, people say, well, you didn't grow up. Is just some of the built environment issues, just mainly the attitude of people, will make immediate assumptions around what I can and I can't do. And I even find now that even the medical profession still makes decisions on life events about how I can live my life. And they're not in the right place to do that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back and have a little bit of a look at your history, because it's very interesting. So where were you born, Margherita?
Born in Melbourne in 1960.
Yeah. When When did you become aware that there was something different about you?
That's an interesting question. Probably about 8. That's when I really noticed that the children around me were starting to shoot up and I wasn't going anywhere fast. So I know at the time the orphanage that I was in organised for a family of short stature to come and visit. I remember they walked in and I was shocked horrid. Because here I was actually seeing a mirror of what people were trying to tell me.
These were people you could look in the face and didn't have to look up to.
Absolutely.
And that must have been quite an amazing experience for you.
It was. And in fact, being a good little Catholic girl at the time, been brought up by nuns, I remember after the event going to church and confessing to God and saying sorry that I was a rebel and that I'd be good and wouldn't be a tomboy. So they were all the discussions that I had at the time. And so I struggled with it for a long time until I got into my teens and then realised that, okay, you know, maybe I'm not going to grow in heart, but I can grow in lots of other ways, you know, with attitudes and things like that.
Most definitely. Margarita, you're quite an amazing person. The way that you approach this. I want to ask you a couple of things about your childhood.
Yeah, sure.
You were brought up in an orphanage.
That's right.
Okay. How come? How did you end up in an orphanage?
I probably need to go back. My mother migrated to Australia on the boat in 1959. She actually fell pregnant on the boat. So when she arrived in Melbourne, she was pregnant, not married. She was meeting her father, which was my grandfather. She spent her pregnancy at the baby's home in Broadmeadows. And for some listeners, they would relate to St. Joseph's baby's home as being the Bawdy babies.
Okay.
So she was there until I was born, and then she signed the adoption papers. Nothing was heard of her after that.
Okay, so you discovered life, you came to life, you came to be in the baby's home in Broadmeadows. And then you were looked after in an orphanage. Was this the same place, or did you move to a different orphanage?
Well, what actually happened was that I spent the first 2.5 years at Broadmeadows, and then I got to an age where I had to move on, so they moved me down to St. Catherine Children's Home in Geelong, and I was there for the first 10 years. And then they transferred me back to Melbourne to St. Vincent de Paul Children's Home.
Okay.
And then I was there in an orphanage and then put into a family group home for the remaining of my teenage years.
Did you have any say in all these moves?
So what was that?
Did you have any say in all these moves?
No. I think I need to explain that once my mother signed the adoption papers, because I wasn't adopted, and in fact, in the 60s, if there was anything medically wrong with the children, they weren't allowed to be adopted. So what actually happened was the welfare decided that I would be made a ward of estate because nobody would adopt an afflicted form child. And that was actually on my welfare files at the time. And
it's quite outrageous, isn't it, by today's standards?
Yeah, and I think, you know, looking back now, that's probably all they knew at the time.
So when you were growing up, you realised that you had dwarfism, that you didn't have a mother and father.
That's correct.
How was your childhood? Did you have people who loved you, Margarita?
In all aspects of, you know, why I had lots of staff coming and going in the orphanage, because, you know, welfare staff did that. Lots of nuns coming in and out. There were always one or two that would constantly check in, make sure that I was okay. Even the children that I was sharing the orphanage with, I think we created a real bond, you know, because that becomes your family.
Mm. That's why I was asking about whether the moves you had any choice, because you'd make bonds with people, and then suddenly you were uprooted and moved somewhere else and had to reform them somewhere else, and that must have been pretty hard for you.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I actually had discussions with people much later, you know, after I left, been in an orphanage after 18 years. The social skills that I had to learn after 18, I had to reprogram everything, you know, because people came in and out and people didn't stick around. So even I found that after the age of 18, forming relationships and friendships with people in mainstream took quite a lot of doing and took a lot to learn to trust people.
Margarita Capellino, Do you feel as though you had an unfair start in life compared to other people?
Absolutely not.
You don't?
No. In fact, I quite often say that my upbringing has definitely shaped me and groomed me for the work and the way I live life now. Had I not had the upbringing, I wouldn't be the person I am now.
Okay. During those years in the orphanage, what was it like? Did you feel as though you were a part of a family, or did you feel as though people were looking after you because they had to?
Look, I think it's fair to say both. There were people who were there just for the job, and that would be with any occupation. But there were also people there who really genuinely did want to nurture the children that were there. So you had that sense. And I think it's only fair to also say that there were people who were there because they had nowhere else to go, work-wise. Mm-hmm. So their sense of, what's the word? So if a nun was a bully, that's all they knew. But at the end of the day, in any farming situation, the same dynamics that were happening in the orphanage would happen in any family.
Okay. So when you were growing up in the orphanage, it was round about 8 that you became aware that you were short statured, that you were dwarf.
Yep.
How did other people treat you when you were... just talk about being a child first, when you were little. Were you treated normally? Did people treat you any differently, do you think, than they would have if you hadn't been dwarf?
Look, I think the holiday parents and staff and people outside the orphanages, there were times where a sense of bullying did occur.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's only fair to say that in those days there was no disability discrimination act. There was no awareness of disabilities. So, and then, people had no idea that what they were doing was not so much unlawful, but because they had no education.
Yes.
So, you know, back then, I saw it quite differently. I know that if people picked on me because I was short, and I should have brought some photos in, but I remember because I was a tomboy, I used to run around and play football. I was not the norm little girl in the orphanage. So I kind of stood out in lots of ways anyway.
Was it a happy time? It sounds as though it wasn't too bad. I would have thought for you in your situation that it would have been a hideous time, but it sounds as though it actually wasn't too bad.
Look, it wasn't too bad in the sense that when I got to know what other people experience in their families and what the reality of, you know, upbringing is for most people, then I was able to make that comparison. Well, what I experienced was really nothing more than what most people would experience.
The people that you grew up with in the orphanage would have been used to you being short stature. That wouldn't have been an issue for them. But people went, and I'm talking about when you were a child,
yep,
but people who didn't know you and only just met you, what was it like for you when people were surprised?
Look, I think in the first instance, I didn't at that time knew to use humour.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the children that were surrounding me at the time were very protective, and they couldn't always be around. So I had to learn some survival skills in a very different way.
Mm-hmm.
So believe it or not, what I used to do is climb up trees and hide. I used to go for long walks and spend a lot of time on my own. But then I realised by doing that, it's not going to solve the problem, isn't it? It's not going to be able to solve the problem when it keeps coming up. I can't keep running away. So what I did was sat there and started talking to people and saying, well, what is so different? You know, is there a way I can get you to understand that I am no different from you?
I have to say that your abilities to cope and deal with this situation are to be admired. I imagine you've probably spoken to other people who are short of stature, who maybe wouldn't have coped as well as you have. Do you know?
I think it's fair to say that irrespective of disability type or sexuality or whatever, individuals actually cope with their labels quite differently, and I think it's fair to say that to people. And yes, you know, having been involved in the Short Stature Association of Australia, you know, for some 40-odd years, the stories are quite different, but the common issues are there. And a lot of it's also it's about coming to terms with the short stature. With me, it was coming to terms not only with being short stature, but also being a lesbian and everything else that went with it.
Yeah, but you see, I mean, the thing is, looking at you, you wouldn't know whether you were a lesbian or not.
That's right.
But you know that you can't avoid the fact that you're short of stature, so I imagine you'd have to come to terms with that first and foremost.
But do you really, actually, Peter, think about it? If Marguerite has been dwarf since she was born, you don't mind me using
the D
word.
Absolutely.
It's easier for the listener to understand. You've been a dwarf since you were born, so there was nothing that you had to suddenly realise or work
out.
It was just who you were and part of your life. Other people might have had a problem with it, but that's not your problem, that's their problem.
Exactly.
Okay. But being a lesbian is a different story. So
I thought that's what I was saying.
Was it?
Mm.
Well, I said it better. Let's go through and have a discussion about your lesbianism.
Okay.
How do you know you're a lesbian?
Well, actually, you probably wouldn't be surprised to any of the listeners that I did have some experiences in the orphanage. But I didn't know at the time that that's what it was.
Okay.
So I just thought it was a common thing that happened. And it wasn't until I left wardship after 18 that I went out to, I think when I had my first job. And I didn't even know sexuality, what it was at the time. And I was at work and then my hairdresser, who I later found out was a gay man, sat me down and said, look, I think you're a lesbian.
Oh, goodness. What criteria did he have to be able to make that assessment?
Well, I better give you a bit of a visual. Just imagine I had full makeup on. I had a skirt that went from the waist to the ground. I had riding boots on. I had a shirt and tie and a vest on and full makeup.
Okay.
So visually, I think he kind of picked up on
a lipstick lesbian.
Yes. Okay, so he said he thinks you're a lesbian. What did you do then?
Oh, I was horrified. I said, what do you mean? What's a lesbian? He said, well, look, darling, I think it's about time we went out. So he took me out to a gay bar.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Which one?
And look, I can remember when it was a university club.
The university club.
Yeah. I remember that.
Oh, how can we all forget university club? 90 Collins Street?
Oh, right, that's
remember
right.
Remember
yes.
floor? Yeah.
I've heard of it. I'm too young to have been there myself.
Yes, and if it's some viewers who have been there, they would remember that the bar was really tall. You couldn't see me at the bar, and there was a long ashtray underneath. And that's where I used to sit. That's where I sat that night, actually, and was quite in awe of everything that happened. But when I got there that night, I had a real strong sense of coming home.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You felt as though you were with people where you belong.
Absolutely.
It's a common thread that runs in through coming out stories, doesn't it?
It does. So from there, it was kind of like, okay, I'm here now. Now what do I do?
And what did you do?
Well, it took me some time to build up the confidence. But one of the things that I think made it easier for me was that the community at that time was really supportive. It was a really family-orientated community. People looked after everybody. And I didn't realise until much later that the late 70s, early 80s, you know, the gay community at that time, there were quite often people said, didn't even know that I was a lesbian. And I don't like the fact that I was still coming out.
I remember you from the 80s.
Oh, dear.
I met you at Pokies.
Oh, the good old Pokies day.
Yes, I remember you from those days. That's a long time ago, Margarita, isn't it?
Dear.
God, how old are we? Don't tell them. Don't tell
them. No.
Well, you're only 28, so.
Yes.
That's right. We both are, aren't we?
Yeah. That's a long time. So you went to the university club and you hung around. Did you meet anybody?
Not in the first instance. And a lot of that was, I think, because at the time I was quite fearful of it. The fact is that I was still learning social skills about being outside of the orphanage. So for me, that was important to learn about mainstream living.
Okay.
And I think that was more important to me at the time. So there were a couple of things that I did that helped along the way. I took up clowning.
Oh, really?
Clowning.
So you
professional
went
clowning
to be a clown.
Develop my social skills. And I also found that people were struggling with the name Margarita.
Yeah, I changed it to Margot. That's how I was introduced to you.
It's Margot.
And in any case, Australians tend to shorten long names, don't they? I mean, that's part of the psyche of
Margarita, I'm a bit interested in this clowning business. Isn't that reinforcing your own stereotype?
Yeah, particularly when I had a clown name, We Won the Clown. I got a lot of work, and at the end of the day, you know, it was a good way of putting a mask on at the time, getting confident with, you know, learning about who I was. And as the years got on, the mask came off, the clown face came off, and I became more confident in doing, you know, work in a different way and communicating with people in a very different way. So it was a good tool to have at that time.
Okay. Margarita Coppolino is with us on Allegro Non Troppo today here on Joy 94.9. We'll continue after this and we'll find out a little bit more about Margarita, about her life, and also about these nude pictures.
Oh, please.
You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network out of local radio station 3JOY, Joy 94.9, Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, on air since 1993. Our special guest on Allegro today is Margarita Coppolino. Margarita is short-statured, commonly called a dwarf. She's a lesbian, she's an orphan, and she's done nude pictures. And we're going to discuss all of that with Margarita in this half hour.
One of the things that I was wondering about, Margarita, was the media impressions of dwarfism, how they're portrayed. So I'm thinking specifically in the TV series Boston Legal, where there's I must say she does it very well. There's a lady there who's a dwarf, and they use it in a humorous way, but they don't put her down or you know, I mean, she's a lawyer, and often they'll be talking, two people will be talking about her, and somebody says shh, and they look down, and she's standing below camera level. So, and they use it in some amusing ways like that. Does that offend you at all?
Look, I can actually say when I was in performing, it quite often was typecast in dwarf roles, and that the media would always, when they were doing stories on things that I was in, would always use the term or dwarf or perhaps... trying to remember the movie Station. Some time ago, there was a movie by the guy who, in a station, and he ended up being an American TV and played a detective. And it took the media was like going, oh, well, there's short such a person on TV, instead of the role that he was playing. I think the other thing that I want to refer to was back in the late 90s when there was a case of a woman, and most readers would remember this, a woman who was 8 months pregnant and the baby was identified as short statured. And her medical profession at the time told her to abort the baby. Now, the media immediately picked up on that article and said that, you know, whilst, you know, it was a very difficult situation, the media at the time were showing very negative points of view of dwarfism and the lifestyles and things like that.
Yeah, because often they're portrayed as comical characters.
Absolutely.
Like, similar to the way in the past that gay men were portrayed. Mm. They were figures of fun.
Yeah, and quite often I'll have people who make an assumption. They'll look at me and make the decision that the work that I actually do is in the disability sector. That's not true. And even, you know, when I've had other forms of media interview me at various times over my life, the thing that they actually wanted to emphasise on was being a dwarf and being a person of a disability and nothing else.
That must get you down.
Yeah, look, it...
Sorry.
No.
But you know what I mean.
I won't swear on radio. At times it's quite frustrating because there's more to an individual than the immediate label that people put on them. And I think it's really important that if we spend more time getting to know more about the person, irrespective of sexuality, irrespective of disability, gender, or other diverse groups that we haven't even mentioned yet.
Mm. Just sometimes when they, if they keep putting these images, these negative stereotypical images up, and focusing just on the fact that you're a dwarf, yep. It must make you so, you must get so pissed off sometimes, do you?
Oh, it does. It does. And in fact, you know, it then encourages people, and it has in the past, where there's been an article, and I've actually had people come up in some state, whether they've been sober or under the influence, and said, oh, well, your body's pretty ugly. So it gives them permission to say some pretty horrible things.
Mm. On the other side of the coin, though, do you find sometimes that people treat you differently because they're trying to be too nice and overcompensating and basically perhaps treating you in a way as a child because they're trying to be so overly nice?
Yeah, and look, in any community that happens, it's just not only your mainstream community, but in the gay community. You know, there's been times where, you know, over the years, where people have been too nice.
Well-intentioned, but condescending.
What is that like? But that happens to everybody.
It does indeed.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things we have to put up with, I guess. You've moved around in the gay community quite a bit. And you've made a lot of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known you for a long time. You were on the Midsummer Board at the same time as I was. I think you were in charge of literature.
That's right, I was.
Okay, so you're not the sort of person to sit at home and weep. You get out and do stuff.
And it's important, you know. At the end of the day, if you want to be part of change, you want to be part of creating a better world, you need to model it and get out there and just do it.
Margarita, let's have a look at this other aspect of your life, which is quite puzzling for me.
Sure.
Your mother. You were born an orphan. Your mother gave birth to you when she was emigrating to Australia.
That's correct.
Right? You were put straight into an orphanage. When you were born, would they have known you were short-statured dwarf when you were born?
Much later, when I was reading through my welfare files, she was asked at the birth. So she would have known that I was short-statured. And in fact, looking at the photos, you can actually pick it.
Okay.
And in some cases, short-statured when they're born, you can't pick it. But with me, it was obvious.
So you were born and you were taken from her, or she left you as soon as you were born?
Absolutely. And that was pretty standard. When babies were removed from the mothers after they signed the adoption papers. So she would have had no form of emotional contact with me at birth at all.
My goodness. That's very confronting, Margarita, actually. I'm quite stunned by that.
Okay.
So when you were growing up in the orphanage, what did you know or think about your mother and your father?
Quite often I used to ask welfare what had actually happened. Quite often I got told lots of different stories around the reality of what really did happen. And it wasn't until I was in my early 20s, and I think it was 1981, when they brought in some new laws that I could actually get access to my welfare files under the Freedom of Information.
The FOI, yep.
Yes, that's right. So I was able to apply for my welfare files, and that's when I actually got the truth, that she was actually pregnant and not married, and she signed the adoption papers. And there was a copy of the papers that she signed on my welfare files. And strangely enough, you know, the first thing I noticed was my signature was exactly the same as hers.
Oh, really?
Mm. So that was the first step of some very interesting things that I discovered along that journey.
This journey that you went on, you went to discover your birth mother.
That's correct.
Tell us about that journey. How did you do it?
Well, when about 21, I actually located my grandparents in Melbourne, and I actually landed on their doorstep. And I remember when I landed on their doorstep, I was just really pleased that I was able to find some family member. And I think the grandparents at the time were in shock, because to me, it never occurred to me that they may have not have known about me.
Oh, goodness. So they didn't know that your mother had had a baby.
Well, I found out much later that they would have had to know somewhere along the line.
Okay.
But they see me turn up on their doorstep.
It would have been a bit of a shock for them.
Well, it was. And for me, you know, it just didn't register that I could have opened a whole can of worms at the time.
How were they when you met them?
I can remember for about half an hour I stood at the gate and they were standing on the front door, and I don't think anybody spoke for about half an hour. And my grandfather slammed the door and walked out. And I remember the friend who took me around, we just took off. I was in a bit of a shock for probably about 48 hours. And I kind of thought, well, okay, this is not a good start to tracking down my mother. So some 2 years later, I got the courage to go back again. And it was almost like my grandparents knew that I would actually turn up again at some stage. And I took a friend who could actually speak Italian, because the dialogue was quite strong. And my grandfather was there, and he said, look, leave us alone. You've already put a nail in the coffin, just leave us alone. I've had a heart attack and all that. So that was their way of dealing with it. So I honoured. I said, yes, I agree to that, and then walked away. So some time later, or should I say some 10 years later, I went to see a clairvoyant. And as I walked into the clairvoyant, he said, I'm not going to give you a reading. Here's a phone number. So I walked away, and a couple of days later, I made the phone call, and it turned out to be a name of an organisation called Vanish, which helps adoptees and natural people find their... Well, they located my mother within 2 days.
Really?
So that was the early 90s.
Goodness.
And I was like, oh, wow. And it occurred to me then that the reason why I wasn't not able to track her, because she'd married, so Coppolino was no longer her name. So I wrote a letter to the address of where she was living at the time. I remember I was interviewed on TV not long after I wrote that letter, and not heard back from her for about 5 years. And what happened was that I was sitting in the pub with the same gay male friend that said that I was a lesbian. We were sitting down in a pub in 95, and he said, look, you've called your mother's phone number for some years. It's about time you rang her. So out comes the mobile, a few strong scotches later, on the phone rings, she answered. I said, oh, it's blah, 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 and she knew exactly who I was. I said, what do you want? I said, well, before you hang up, I'm not ringing up to cause any trouble, I'm just ringing up just to say hello and just see how you are and get some sense of understanding of what happened. So she told me her version, and her version was, well, you know, she came and she had no choice, and being a single mother, you know, it would have been very difficult for her. So I acknowledged that, and I said, look, thank you for allowing me to live. And that's what I finished the conversation with, and said goodbye. And we had a bit of a giggle at the end. And I can remember, you know, the laughter and both sounding very alike in the phone voice. And just feeling really good that I'd had that opportunity to say thank you, and that I've forgiven her. And then hung up the phone, and I felt really good about it.
So all of this exploration ended up in a 20-minute phone call, and yet you have been able to resolve all of your internalised issues about your mother from that 20-minute phone call?
Absolutely.
Really?
By having that contact with her, and then I think the other part of the journey was for me to go back to the village where she came from.
Okay.
Which I undertook that journey last year. And it's taken me a long time to get the courage to go back to Sicily and find the village where she came from. And I don't know if you've ever been to Sicily. It's 99% of the people there speak Italian. I don't speak Italian at all. I turn up and everybody's looking at me going, you look very Italian. You have a passport with an Italian name, but you cannot speak the language. And the people that were taking me around and showing me the parts of Sicily where my mother was from were getting all very excited, because they were taking me back to where my mother was coming from, and that there were possibilities that I might connect with some of the family members.
You might have relatives there. And yeah. Did you?
When we turned up at the village, the first thing the interpreter did was took us to the register, and then some hours later he had interpreted, this is what I was there for, and the guy kept looking at me, the hand was going like this, whoa, and scratching, and I thought, oh, have I come at it? Have I said, or have I done something not really good? He said, no, 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 in fact, come, you know, there'll be lots of people in the village that all want to meet you. We don't care what happened, you know, some 40-odd years ago. Come to the village. We now know who you are. Why would you know that your mother had another child? We now accept you. So for me, the journey was really important because the village got to know that I was no longer a secret and I got accepted by the village.
Oh, that's great.
And the rest of the family, had all migrated to Australia some 40-odd years ago.
Where is your mother now?
Still in Australia. The exact location now, I'm not aware.
Will you ever get in touch with her again?
Actually, no. And I think, would I see her? I can't answer that. If it happens out of coincidence, that maybe.
Margarita Coppolino, have you forgiven your mother?
Absolutely.
Because what she did, I don't wish to play devil's advocate here, but let's just look at the facts. She was pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
She left you in an orphanage, a dwarf,
mm-hmm.
alone for all of your life. She didn't give you any love. She didn't give you any attention. What did she give you?
She gave me her heart. She gave me determination. She gave me lots of the Italian herbs, warmth.
Anger? Were you ever angry with her?
Look, I think in the earlier stages in the orphanage, because I didn't know anything and because of my immaturity at the time, absolutely. But as I've got older and understood, you know, how people lives, you know, how it impacts. You know, and I think it's important, you know, like, if I had to remain angry, would I be the person I am now?
Part of the process of healing is forgiveness.
Absolutely.
This is probably one of the hardest things I could ever think anybody would have to forgive, but you seem to have done it. What about your father?
Well, the situation about my father is that I found out much later when there was a question asked about my father. My mother recalled that she was raped. So for her, there's no sense of who my father is. In fact, she wouldn't know because she actually fell pregnant by rape on the boat.
Oh, my goodness gracious. That's quite confronting. So where does that put you, Margarita?
Where does that put me? Well, he's around somewhere.
An orphan whose mother was raped. Dwarf. Lesbian. My goodness gracious. You must be one of the strongest people I've ever met because you're quite happy and quite accepting about everything.
Well, it's the only way that I've become really comfortable, you know, in life. You know, the more comfortable you are with yourself, the more you invite people to be comfortable with you.
I think that's very wise advice, Margarita.
So you can only move on if you accept your situation as it is. If you're living a life of denial, then you can never grow.
That's right, you know, and you've just got to be able to say, well, look, you know, this is the reality. Now, what can I do, you know? Like my old frame of reference, you know, what I was like in the orphanage. That's what I knew, but then I moved on and tried something different. And because I tried something different, I became more positive instead of blaming situations and walking around with a chip on my soul and saying, well, you know, I have a belief that I can control 80% of what happens in my life, 20% is destiny.
Okay, that's a pretty good philosophy. So what do you do now? What's your career, Margarita Coppolino?
What do I do now? I'm currently working for a government department as a manager of access and inclusion. So what that means is that I focus on making sure that operational, that we don't discriminate, we practice human rights, we're inclusive of everything that we do internally and externally.
Okay. Now, you've been a bit of a naughty girl. Tell us about these nude pictures.
Oh.
That was in the article in El Globo that I was reading. It was the first thing I saw. It says that you stripped off and you did some nude pictures. What are you like?
And it wasn't at Pokey, let me tell you. Well, any of those or any of those bars, I've never stripped off nude there. But okay. I did strip off nude for an exhibition called Intimate Encounters. And Belinda Mason actually did an exhibition of people with disabilities in intimate positions. And she was in Melbourne doing the original launch, and I met her. And she said, why don't you become a subject matter? And I said, oh, no way. Got to be joking. And then after some time, you know, I got to know her, and she got to know me. The trust built up. She said, look, you know, I think it would be really good for you to do it. So I eventually agreed, and she interviewed me my background and my fears and my beliefs. And then about 2 weeks before the agreed photo shoot in Sydney, she rang me and said, I've got the image. This is what I want you to do. I said, I'm listening. She said, I want you to go full frontal nude. Because of your upbringing, nobody would have seen your warts and all, and you've got nothing to hide. And I went, right. Everything in my whole body just kind of dropped. And I remember the first thing that was, my head was saying, oh, I better go to the gym, I better shave my legs, and I better change this. And then about 5 minutes later, I kind of went, this is not what this is about. You know, why am I thinking everything about changing my image to have a perfect photo of me being nude? So I just decided to turn up in Sydney 2 weeks later and have photos with hairy legs and the body shape it was at the time. Got on the plane, went to Sydney. Took Belinda some hour to get me to strip. She eventually got me with my clothes off. Within an hour, she had me parading around the studio, taking all these photos. Some 3 hours later, oh, more? And what was really funny was that I had a corporate women's gig that I had to do that afternoon at AMP, and I had to talk about leadership.
Goodness.
And I turned up, and I was on such a high turning note that all I talked about, well, I just came anybody in here to do a nude photo, and they just explained what happened. And I was going, that's what I talked about for the hour at the AMP.
Gosh.
It must have taken some courage to do that. I mean, I can imagine myself, if anybody asked me to do it, I'd be very, very reluctant.
But then when you do it, there's a certain hurdle, there's a transition, there's a point, a threshold.
Yes.
And you feel this, and then all of a sudden that threshold's gone. It's a bit like the coming out experience, you know.
It is.
Very anxious, and then suddenly when you've done it, you suddenly have this new freedom. Doing this sort of thing, posing nude, was the same sort of experience for you, but more so for you because of the isolation that you've had in your life.
Absolutely, and probably with what was really good, that the first showing of the photo, as in full length, was actually displayed at the Gay Games in Sydney.
Okay.
Which wasn't supposed to happen that way, but it did. So I went up for the opening of the exhibition. For some readers who remember Gay Games in Sydney, there were people everywhere. And I kept having people going past saying, great bod, great bod. And I'm saying, I had clothes on. And it didn't occur to me that they'd been to see the exhibition. That was kind of nice, getting great bod.
So where's the exhibition now? Where are the pictures now?
It's currently travelling around Australia at all the local government areas. It's been in London, travelling around UK, and it's also in America and New Zealand.
Have you seen them?
Yes.
What did you think?
I almost want to do another one. I want to do one, you know, some 10 years later, say, well, how different would it look now?
It's quite an interesting story, Margarita Coppolino. You're not the sort of person to take all of this lying down.
No.
You don't take any bullshit from anybody.
Absolutely.
And you meet it head on, all the challenges of life you meet head on. A lot of people listening today face impossible challenges in their own lives. Have you got a message that you could give to these people who are facing incredible challenges, perhaps a reflection of your own courage? Would you say that you're a courageous person?
Oh, I'd just say I'm pretty much an average, everyday person. In fact, I have a strong belief that everybody has a story to tell, you know, and the more that people tell their story, the more they move on.
Okay. So the message of support would be?
Do the journey, do it gracefully, and just embrace the changes that come along with it.
Sounds pretty good. Margarita Coppolino, it's been fascinating to have you on Allegro Non Troppo and hear your story and share it with everybody. You're quite an inspiring person, because all of the things, if we do a stock take of the things that could have made your life different, the fact that you're a dwarf, that you're an orphan, that you're a lesbian, and that you've been in nude pictures, would it be pornography? Not really.
That depends on how you look at it.
Okay. Yet you face all of these challenges head on, without apology and with courage and conviction. Margarita, it's been wonderful to have you on Allegro Non Troppo.
And it's been an honour being here. Thank you.
Okay. We'll be back next week with Allegro Non Troppo. Peter, we're doing an ARC special over the next few weeks. We're going to be looking at Anzac Day. Coming up to Anzac Day is one of the most important times in Australia, from my point of view, and we're going to do a three-week special on Anzac Day. We're going to interview Professor Ivan Holmes, one of my colleagues, who was in Papua New Guinea and involved in a lot of combat against the Japanese. We're going to talk to author Michael Veitch about his two books, Flak and Fly. And then we're going to talk to a couple of people, including Lee Visser, about experiences of being gay and in the army. So this is leading up to Anzac Day, which is on the 25th of April this year. Also coming up on Allegro Non Troppo, I'd just like to invite the listener. We have a special show coming up on the 3rd of May called Like a Virgin. And this is to do with first sexual experiences. We would like to invite the listener to go to the Allegro webpage, allegro.org.au, and fill in the survey to tell us a little bit about first sexual experiences. Because I'm very interested to find out how one's first sexual experience reflects on the rest of your life. If you have a very positive first sexual experience, are you going to have a happier life? If you have a very bad sexual experience, are you going to have an unhappy life? How does it translate into the rest of your life?
I mean, I guess it depends on just how what sort of first sexual experience it is, because I think for a lot of people, the first time isn't particularly good, or not necessarily a good experience. But I don't think it would really, unless it was really dramatic, wouldn't affect you the rest of your life too much, I wouldn't have thought.
But you're only speaking out of your experience and what you know. Yet for a lot of people, it's like it's the biggest thing in their lives, is that they're going to lose their virginity.
Well, there's a lot of expectation put on it, isn't there?
And in a lot of cultures and societies, the first sexual experience is the pivotal point where life changes forever. And I guess that's true up to a point. When you think of the first, I'm not talking about messing around as kids. I'm talking about the first full-on sexual experience. It's quite an amazing thing to think about.
Yeah, well, that'll be a fascinating show.
Yep, so that's coming up. So if you'd like to take part and have some input into that, you can by going to the Allegro website, allegro.org.au. We'll be back next week, everyone, with another Allegro Non Troppo. Bye.